Good evening and welcome to HealthBeat. HealthBeat is the WDIY program done along with our friends and supporters from the Leonard Parker Poole Institute for Health. I am your host, Greg Caponia, along with my co-host, Edward Meehan, the executive director of the Leonard Parker Poole Institute for Health. Welcome, Ed.
Thanks, Greg. Good evening to you, and it's always great to have this conversation.
Ed, as some of our listeners know, I am retiring tomorrow, and this will be my last HealthBeat recording. Before we get into the topic of the social determinants of health, I would like to thank you both personally for your friendship and on behalf of WDIY, thank you for helping WDIY present this important program to benefit the health of our local Lehigh Valley. Thank you very much.
Our pleasure, Greg. And on behalf of Ryder Poole Foundation and the Leonard Parker Poole Institute for Health, DIY is a very important asset in the community, and the work you've done is just fantastic. So it's been our pleasure to work with you. And as we write in the yearbook, best wishes for all future endeavors.
Thank you, sir. Well, and for our listeners, rest assured, HealthBeat will continue every month right here on WDIY. So Ed, let's reflect back a little bit, if that's okay. Ed, you don't do this work for four decades like you have unless there is a strong personal and emotional connection. Can you take me back to your days as a kid on the Lower East Side of Manhattan? How did young Edward become connected to community health?
Thanks for asking, Greg. Let me tell you first, I've just finished David Brooks's book, The Second Mountain. And at one point in this book, and he writes so well, he's talking about urban renewal and how, with the best of intentions, many, many cities tore down substandard housing, but in the same time, they ripped up what fabric of community was holding lots of people together and keeping them healthy and connected. And that's basically what happened to me as a young child. Dan Boskett talked about this similar experience when we had him on the air talking about his time in Allentown and urban renewal and how it pretty much ripped up the African-American community in Allentown.
Right.
So, you know, as a friend of mine who worked in Jersey City and Newark said, you know, sometimes you can tear down a perfectly good ghetto. And in fact, that's what happened when I was a kid. I was about 4 years old, and the neighborhood was being torn down. I was wrapped in cotton as a kid. I mean, I felt comfortable, and my parents were comfortable. We knew everyone. Everyone knew us for generations. And as the neighborhood was tearing down, people were moving to Queens, and just the diaspora of basically lower-income white and African-American and Latino communities, and particularly in Manhattan and the Bronx and Brooklyn. And so my grandfather, who was not a particularly religious man, goes to the parish priest and says, we have to stand, we have to fight, we have to preserve the community. And the parish priest said, you can't fight City Hall. Now, I was 4 years old, but that sunk in my head. And what sunk in my head was, how do you fight City Hall? So I kind of grew up with that. The whole neighborhood moved except for us. My grandma wouldn't move, so therefore my mom wouldn't move. And if my mom didn't move, we weren't moving. And I ended up living in the Al Smith Projects, public housing projects, just a little ways away from just one neighborhood over. And it wasn't the worst public housing projects in the city of New York, but it's still public housing. And one of my early memories there was that my mom and dad were just terrific folks, and my mom was quite a community builder herself. So picture, we live on the fourth floor in the projects of a 17-story building. And the continuing assault on breaking up community is that in their wisdom, the developers had built a 17-story building with one elevator that only went to the odd floors and one elevator that only went to the even floors. So as you can imagine, on the fourth floor, we knew everybody on 6, 8, 10, 12. The people on 3 and 5 were the weirdos from the other elevator. They're the people who's stomping on the floor you heard. They're the people whose fights you heard. Those are the people who are really weird. So you'd wait in the lobby waiting for the elevator, which at any given time might be working, and realize that you just didn't know the other people on the other side of the lobby who took the other elevator because they were weird. They lived on the odd floors. But that said, my parents, so picture the fourth floor, we live in 4A. Mrs. Perez lives in 4B and has no English. Mr. and Mrs. Martinez live in 4C and speak very good English and very good Spanish. Popola, who's across the hall from us in 4D, only speaks Yiddish. But my mom and dad grew up on the Lower East Side, and they've got passable Yiddish. And then in 4E is Mr. Chin, who has no English or Spanish, but kind of gets along by hand gestures and that sort of thing. So when the incinerator would break, or there'd be some sort of notice that you'd get about whatever it might be, rent increase or whatever, Mr. Martinez would translate into Spanish, and my mom would translate to Popola and Pidgin Yiddish. And Mr. Chin would just go with hand gestures and kind of work it all out. So, community runs deep for me. The assault on community runs deep for me. Credit to my parents for all their hard work and their tenacity. And credit to the New York City education system, because I had an opportunity to go to Stuyvesant High School, which was formative, got me out of the neighborhood. Hunter College, again, City University, fantastic education I received, and was just up and out from there. Education was the ticket for me.
Ed, talk about how living around people with different cultures can benefit a person, especially a young person. What do you get from that?
People ask me, what was it like? And I say, well, I don't have any way to differentiate. I mean, that was my life. And I just figured everybody did that. It was very odd to, realize. Well, let me put it this way, Greg. I'd see depictions of families and communities on television, Leave It to Beaver or Donna Reed, and say, that doesn't exist. That's make-believe. That just simply doesn't exist. So I grew up with this natural inclination to say there are lots of different cultures. There's lots of different ways to do things, and they're all rich and wonderful. The music, the food, everything. So, I was just so lucky and so blessed to have that exposure. It's good for everybody, absolutely good for everybody. But it's hard for me sometimes to realize that folks resist that. Why would you? It's just amazing to learn about other cultures.
Ed, Alabama's been in the news recently, and I know you spent some time working in Montgomery, Alabama, focusing on infant mortality, teenage pregnancy. As a New Yorker who ends up in the Deep South, how did that influence your work first there? Maybe you could give us a couple of snapshots into what it was like working in Montgomery.
Sure. The hop there that I'd have to describe first is the script was fairly written for me. All my faculty who became friends at Hunter were all graduates of Columbia and also had dual appointments at Columbia. So the script that was written was, Ed's going to go to graduate school at Columbia, go to get a job at the New York City Health Department, and live in Rego Park. And two things. One is that New York City went broke about that time, and it was really difficult to be thinking about a career in civil service. And the other is that I was really looking for a way to scrape off a little bit of the New York and get some broader exposure. So the University of North Carolina had an excellent school of public health, has an excellent school of public health. And so Chapel Hill was kind of an introduction to the South, which was wonderful. Again, fantastic education. And I met a couple of fellas in Chapel Hill who were just visiting. I had broken a finger playing ball. So you have to picture I'm all gungy and with a broken finger and splinted up to my elbow. And the administrator in the department says, hey, there's two fellas asking questions about infant mortality. That's something you're interested in. Go talk with them. So I met these two guys, and after about 2 hours of conversation, realized that one was the medical director for the state of Alabama's public health department on maternal and child health, and the other was the administrator. And they said, hey, if you were in Montgomery, you'd have a job right now. And I said, well, in about 3 months, I need a job. How about it? So my wife was crazy enough to come along with me. So another hop to Alabama. Alabama is in so many ways an amazingly good and wonderful place. I met some terrific people. And at the same time, as we know, there are so many challenges. And I learned so much. It was an amazing education. But so, Greg, picture the New York Yankee Catholic working for the federal government, assigned to the George Wallace administration, working on teenage pregnancy. What could possibly go wrong? So that was what I did. And I got to work with a lot of community folks, particularly in Montgomery. Mr. E.D. Nixon, who was just an amazing, towering figure in the community, for one. I didn't work closely with him, but basically I needed his blessing to do community work. And when he said I was okay, doors opened. Ms. Inez Baskin, just a wonderful person, and she was so gracious to invite me over to lunch at her home several times to kind of, teach me the ropes a little bit and understand what was going on. So we get a lot of resonance around infant mortality and teenage pregnancy, and I thought I was doing really, really well. It took me about 6 or 8 months to realize it's not that I was doing really well. It's that these folks realized that organizing was the game. And if infant mortality is the crisis du jour that federal government and money and resources being put into, they're all about it. But organizing and coalescing of the community and cohesion at the community level was their agenda. And when I realized that, I was also absolutely all for it. So it was a great thing to learn and something that I think I hold with me going forward. We had a load of successes. Infant mortality in some counties in Alabama at the time were worse than 30 or so developing nations in the late 1970s and early 1980s. And there were a lot of innovations that happened. And then with a change of administration, there was no money and it all dried up and went away, and including my job. And I didn't make a whole lot of friends in the Alabama State Health Department, so it was time to go, and took a job in Allentown, PA.
So what did you learn there, or what type of, how did that influence your work here in Lehigh Valley?
I think one of the very important things is when you are working for an organization. I moved here to be the executive director of a program for stroke, for cerebral vascular disease across the Lehigh Valley. And so I have an agenda. And when I go to talk with community leaders or a school or a church group, I'm presenting an agenda. And I think what happens oftentimes is we forget that these community units, they have their own agenda. They have very sophisticated agendas, and we have to respect that. And in fact, what we need to do is figure out how our agenda relates to what's going on in their lives and can we be of service to them. So I think that's an important switch. Who's calling the shot? When you come in and say, I have a program I'd like to pitch to you, why wouldn't the reaction from community leaders be, who are you and who asked for you? How do you develop a relationship such that you can say, we think we have something that could be valuable, but we need you to pressure test it and make sure that it is consistent with the culture and the history and the ethos of the community that you serve, and how can we be of service?
So Ed, how do you do that? How do you be an outsider and then become a friend to a community to the point where, they'll listen and trust?
I think the first thing is you listen, and with a great deal of humility, you listen. I think to be of service, you really have to try to understand. And, communities are generally excited to tell their story if you take the time. But if you come in with a cookie cutter, it just becomes that much more difficult to have some sustainable work. Communities, again, have history, they have longevity. You don't want to be the flavor of the month. So how you do it, I think, is something that we say here all the time, is to play the long game. How do you really think about the fact that the community's got a long history? They've seen folks like you come and go. Why should they trust you? Why should they feel comfortable with you? So learn, pay attention, listen to what's going on, respect what the voice of the community is, and try to configure what you have to offer in a way that would be recognized as having value. So the switch of sort of the power, if you will, from what you bring to what they need is key.
So you worked a lot, you have a lot of experience in infant mortality, teenage pregnancy in the South. Then you end up making some major strides in stroke prevention in Pennsylvania. What did you learn from the previous role that would translate into your job as the executive director at the Pool Trust and working on stroke prevention and things like that?
Well, again, the progression from understanding community as a kid as best as I could to being prepared for it and learn about the background and preparation and training of education around community health, both at Hunter and North Carolina, and then the total immersion into a culture that was foreign to me in Alabama got me realizing that, well, Pennsylvania is not Alabama. There's a whole different culture. And even though I grew up 90 miles away, I didn't know a lot about the Lehigh Valley. I didn't know a whole lot about Allentown or Bethlehem or Easton or any of the small towns. And I had to kind of get into the rhythm of an understanding of how things work here and how are things organized. Some of the things that were in common, especially around stroke, were faith-based communities. So we did really good work with a lot of church groups, had that in common, but they were UCC instead of CC, or they were Catholic instead of Southern Baptist. But nonetheless, cohesion in the community level, certainly in the 1980s and 1990s, was very faith-based oriented. Just learning the culture and the style was important, and realizing that wherever you go, that's true. How do you get an understanding of how decisions get made? Who are important leaders? What role do they play? How can you fit in a way that would be helpful?
And you ended up as the executive director of the Pool Trust and the Ryder Pool Foundation. How did you make that transition? How did they find you? How did you find them?
Well, first, I can't talk about the stroke program without a shout out to Dr. Larry Levitt. Dr. Levitt was a pool trustee and was an associate of Leonard Poole. And of course, as a neurologist, very interested in stroke. And so he had the idea of putting together a stroke program, which was very, very helpful. Part of my coming to the Lehigh Valley was that the stroke program, I answered an ad in the New York Times. You can't get any more cold call than that. But
really?
the ad in the New York Times said, 9 hospitals want to work together on cerebrovascular disease, looking for an executive director. And I was so intrigued that 9 hospitals were working together on anything that I said, I have to check this out. This sounds like an interesting challenge. And when I got here, I realized that 90% of the funding for the stroke program was Pool Trust. And then I learned about Pool Trust. So about a year into my being here, they found themselves without the Pool trustees found themselves without an executive director, asked me if I would help out. And so, Greg, in those days, that was go in the office, check the codaphone for any messages, you know, things of that sort. And after about a year of being interim executive director of Pool, I said, you know, this is a real job. You really need to do a search. And the trustees at the time, Leon Holt, Ed Donnelly, Larry Levitt, said, you know, why don't you do it? And so I kind of backed into the foundation role, if you will. But I think part of what qualified me was that I worked on soft money for a good number of years and knew what it was like on the other side of the table. So the role of being the funder was one that I took with a great deal of seriousness and tried to hold true to the things we've just talked about in terms of learning community and understanding how to do the work.
And of course, those experiences that you had as a younger person growing up in a community that had many different cultures had to help.
Yes. I was thinking about our show this evening and thinking, you know, picture 1981 when I moved to the Lehigh Valley, rented a house in South Whitehall, and but just take a ride, you know, just go for a ride to try and connect the dots, figure out what communities where, and maybe go all the way out in the country, like maybe Fogelsville, and, you know, walk into a small store and everybody would be speaking Pennsylvania German and switch to English for our benefit or not benefit. But but at any rate, I'm not sure. I think a lot of the Pennsylvania German culture needs to be preserved. I think it's important. But I think it's this generation, next generation, it's an important thing to do. And then, of course, we've had a change in ethnicity and race of folks in the Lehigh Valley, large numbers of folks, largely Latino, coming from the islands, coming from North Jersey and coming from New York City. And I've been there, seen it. It works. It can happen. It's not a bad thing. And I think we're increasingly beginning to understand and embrace the next iteration of people who are looking for the American dream and finding that the Lehigh Valley is a wonderful place to find the American dream.
And it's done a nice job recreating itself. I'm a Rust Belt kid too. You know, I've watched these communities over the past 40 years fall apart kind of because of the change in the way business is done and then rebuild. But the Lehigh Valley sticks out in my mind because of the progress that it's made. When you look back on the past 40 years, what are some of your primary takeaways and what are the lessons that you've learned?
I think big picture primary takeaways, quoting or paraphrasing Peter Block, what is the story that a community tells itself? And to a great degree, you know, there's a stoicism in a way about the Lehigh Valley, and yet the innovation and willingness to change and try new things belies that story. I mean, it's been a very innovative region with people who get things done. So big picture, I think that's amazing. And, you know, happy to be part of that. In terms of the growth and evolution, we have a lot of challenges. We have a lot of disparity in health, but the disparity in health is also related to many other disparities having to do with housing, access to education, public safety, food and nutrition. And there's still a lot more work to be done. It's in our collective interest to make sure that everyone participates in this challenge that we have, because it's for all of our collective benefit. That's important work. Secondly, I'd say the important role, and I don't think we talk about this enough, the important role of not-for-profit organizations. I think folks understand the role of government, folks understand the role of the private sector, but there's a not-for-profit sector that's really super important and does really, really good things. And I think that we're blessed to have many not-for-profit organizations. I would emphasize for me that one of the key elements of having good, strong not-for-profit organizations is having really good trustees or board members, and that strong governance is important. Setting a strategic agenda and sticking with it is very, very valuable. And that will help you attract strong leadership, where you can hire an executive director who can fulfill the mission and make sure that the trustees are on board members are doing a good job with the mission. So, Greg, things I've learned about being a funder, and I would say big picture, everyone does the 1 year or 3 year grant. This work has got to be measured in 10 year chunks. So how do you work with all the not-for-profit community to say the vision for what we want is at least 10 years out? How do we think about sustainable programs and that are strategic, that connect in a way that will work? So as a funder, some of the things that I tried to do was make sure we had a strategic agenda for our philanthropy, that we were an honest broker. In other words, we weren't coming in with a fixed agenda, that we were willing to listen, and that we weren't personally deriving any benefit from the work that we were supporting, but it was for the greater good. And this is just a political fact, but, you know, government oftentimes, you have the leadership has to worry about the next election, has to worry about terms of office. And foundations can transcend that political term of office, which means that if something is an election year, you can keep going. With all due respect to our elected officials, not-for-profit foundation work, philanthropy is not government, so you can move more rapidly and adroitly, but you can move more rapidly with relatively small amounts of funding. So how do you make sure that small amount of funding is used to be timely and flexible and strategic? One of our mantras with Pool has always been first dollar in. I don't know that we were first dollar in with WDIY, but we were pretty close. So how the first dollar in can be a small dollar, but it's the good housekeeping seal of approval and couldn't leverage other funds going forward.
At almost 30 years here. Next year is the 30th anniversary of the station.
Yes. Ira Farrow came to talk with me, and I think I just about grabbed him by the lapels and said, we need community radio. I grew up with community radio. Ira, we need to do this. We need to do this. And he was saying, okay, I guess you're in.
Well, we've had a conversation, we've had many conversations about how important art is to our community and the well-being of our community. And I hope WDIY is continuing to fill that mission as the Pool, first the Ryder Pool Foundation and now the Parker Pool Institute for Health. We've got about 4 minutes left. Ed, tell me, what are you really proud of? I mean, there's a lot to be proud of, but, what makes you smile when you come to the office?
I first had fantastic board members over the years, really good trustees who are very, very conscientious, who really took the role and the mission very seriously. I work with a great staff of people who are just fantastic. And there are so many things, you know, that the Pool Fellowship for Health, that's now in its 10th year. Some of the folks are doing amazing work, and their ability to work with one another enhanced by the fellowship, that makes me smile. That's really good stuff. The things that I think work are the realization that this work is iterative. In other words, we could not do some of the things we're doing now if it wasn't for some things we did 5 years ago or 10 years ago. So each effort to try to build community, to try to focus on what are the things that would enable people to be healthy are built on trial and error, but hopefully a thoughtful, experience-based role in thinking about what did we learn and how do we go forward. So that experience, that iterative work makes me smile, and the realization that the work goes on is really important. It's got to continue. It continues with me, without me. I think we all realize we have a role to play, and at some point it's time to let the next person do that work. What's next for me is I need to take a time out, and I'll be thinking a little bit about what my second act is, but I think I need to get a little bit back in touch with more of my artistic side and not my public health side, for one. And what's next for the work is continuation of the Leonard Parker Pool Institute for Health and its leadership, and working together to build better communities and healthier communities. So that's the work continues. The work is important, and the work continues.
So, Ed, are you moving along here?
I am retiring,
Ed,
in April.
Okay. Well, wow, you have a lot to be proud of.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
You have a lot to be proud of.
It's been a heck of a 40 plus years of work, and really good stuff. And my compliments to all the people who make the Lehigh Valley a better place to live. It's really good. I've found now that I've been telling people that I'm retiring. They say, "So where are you going to move to?" It's like the Lehigh Valley is now my home. It's weird. I identify as a New Yorker, but I've lived here longer than I ever lived in New York. So that's, I guess, just the way it goes. But yeah, this is an amazing place, and we're going to continue to live in the Lehigh Valley.
Well, I guess, Ed, we're both out of time. I'm retiring tomorrow, and you're off in April. You know, as we close the show, Ed, I want to thank you, to you and the Leonard Parker Pool Institute for Health, and of course, let's give a shout out to Ron Dendis, our retired friend, who's probably listening in this evening or will on the web. I'd also like to thank your team, Bridget, doing an outstanding job for the trust, and also Matt Trust, who's also been very, very helpful and will continue to be very helpful. So, folks, the show will still be around. We're turning the keys over to some folks that know what they're doing. Ed, we're going to keep the mission going.
That sounds great, Greg. Thank you so much for everything that you have done to work with WDIY and advance community radio. You've done such a fantastic job. Wow. Thank you so much, and compliments to WDIY.
Okay, Ed. Well, with this said, I'd like to remind our listeners that this program is available online at WDIY.org, on the WDIY app also, and you are listening to WDIY 88.1 FM. I'm your host, Greg Caponia, wishing everyone in the Lehigh Valley good health, and have a great evening. If you enjoyed this program, please go to the WDIY website or app to share or become a WDIY member.